Well, g'day everyone, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Diwa De Boer, who is a media commentator and one of the more thoughtful voices involved in the new right in New Zealand today. Today we discuss the current political landscape in New Zealand and its unusual voting system, what has changed and what hasn't since Jacinta Ardern has left and a new centre-right government has taken power in that country, the role of New Zealand First and its leader, Winston Peters, who has been one of the few genuinely nationalist politicians who has held senior cabinet positions in an Anglo-Commonwealth country, and his friendship with Donald Trump, the divide between Boomer and Zoomer conservatism in New Zealand, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Diwa De Boer, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
No problem. I was just thinking before I reached out that my earliest memories are actually from New Zealand because I spent a bit of time there as a kid in Taranaki and those beautiful pebble beaches and the rest of it. And I think Australians generally have a fondness for New Zealand. Many have family ties and other connections. But I suspect that many here, and indeed across the Anglosphere, are probably not as familiar with the political scene as they probably should be. Is it okay if you just sort of, you know, set the scene? I know you've got a new centre-right government in power, but it's more complicated than I think some people appreciate. So it might be just worth sort of describing the lay of the land.
I can certainly do that. And the first thing I'd have to say about your comment of growing up in New Zealand and now living in Australia is that this seems to be our number one export, seems to be exporting New Zealanders over to Australia. And part of that is the political situation in New Zealand, where I'm an immigrant in New Zealand. I've been here for over 20 years now. It's my home. My wife is her family goes way back to the beginning of New Zealand. So my kids are proper New Zealanders. And it's an interesting part of New Zealand's history as being sort of the little brother of Australia. And that's caused us a lot of problems as well, because we're actually officially poorer than all of your states, even poorer than Tasmania. I think they've got a bad rep in Australia. But you know, from an economic perspective, it's very difficult for us. And so we have an issue with a lot of immigration to Australia because of bad economic management here in New Zealand. And then people say, oh, well, it's greener on the other side of the ditch. So the current political situation is definitely better than it was. We had a world-famous government during the all of the COVID response, the COVID regime of Jacinda Ardern, who was world-famous for one of the strictest COVID lockdowns. And I know Australia had a few of those too. But that hit New Zealand pretty hard economically as well. And so we're still suffering a lot of those effects and a lot of a record number of people leaving New Zealand in the last 2 years is largely because of that. The election probably was a bit of a backlash to that. And we got a centre-right government. So it's made up of three parties. One is the National Party, which is sort of more like the Liberal Party in Australia, I guess. They're more so a Liberal Party than a Conservative Party, but they do have a conservative faction, socially conservative faction, but they tend to be very muzzled. They don't speak very much about actual conservative issues. They never try to turn back anything that Labour does. And our Labour government probably historically is similar to yours. The other two parties in that coalition then are a more libertarian party, the ACT Party. They're not quite as libertarian as your libertarians, I would say, from what I've seen from your libertarians, but they've really morphed into more of a broadly modern liberal party. They've adopted a lot of policies around economic growth, deregulation, kind of they've picked up some of the anti-wokeness in terms of racial equality in New Zealand. So they're much more liberal, and we would say left wing on many other social issues. So they are very much in favor of euthanasia, abortion, any kind of social issue that you can think of. And they're pro trans as well, and on and on it goes. All the social issues, they are very left on that.
Perhaps it's worth describing the voting system, because you guys don't have states. You're not a federation like Australia or the United States. You don't have an upper house, as I understand it, but you do have quite an odd voting system which the parties have to play by. Maybe it's worth sort of describing some of the...
I think it's good to mention that. I mean, the final component of the coalition is New Zealand First, which is a more nationalist-oriented party. They describe themselves as centrist. Most people would say they're more right-wing. But because of the voting system in New Zealand, which stands for says MMP, which stands for mixed member proportional system, essentially, if you get 1% of the votes, you get 1% of the seats. But there is a minimum threshold, so you need at least 5% of all of the votes that are cast. These are called party votes. So you pick the party that you want to put into power, party that you want in parliament, and again, as well, it's just a single house, and you cast that party vote. If they get more than 5%, they'll get that proportion of the seats, and they balance out. We also have a second vote. We do have electorates as well, which are standard first past the post elections, where the candidate that gets the most votes in that seat wins that seat, but they don't affect the makeup of parliament. Sort of an interesting system where you can win those seats, but unless you get fewer party votes than you have electorates, it doesn't affect the outcome. Now, we currently have a big overhang in parliament. Our parliament is normally 120, but we have 123 seats, three extra seats. And this is because the Maori Party, which is in opposition, a very left-wing party at the moment, and they got quite a few electorates that they won, because we have seven Maori electorates. So they're sort of race-based electorates, where if you're Maori, you get to vote in those electorates. And they won those seats, the Maori Party, six of them, but they only won 1.5% of the popular vote, which means that they got those seats that they won, but it was an addition to the usual proportion of parliament.
Is it correct to say that these smaller parties would not win more traditional lower house electorates in New Zealand were it not for this particular voting system?
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why it was brought in, to sort of deal with the issues that New Zealand had at one point, where some of these parties that were opposed to the two-party system, the National Party and the Labour Party, you had several of these parties that would sometimes clock in, say, 20% of the vote and get almost no seats. So that drove the political change in New Zealand, although it happened before I was on, before I was here, before I was born even, shortly after. It was 97 that the political system changed in New Zealand. That has allowed for more parties to be represented in New Zealand's parliament. And it seemed to be quite stable in that the current six parties that we have been around for most of that time. Entry by new parties is still very difficult, if not even some would say impossible, for new parties to actually come in and break that 5% threshold, because it's so difficult to carve off 5% of the votes without the existing six parties that exist on the political spectrum defending themselves against your attempt to do that.
Got it. And interestingly, at least I think interesting from my perspective, New Zealand and Winston Peters, New Zealand First, they are a nationalist party of the kind that other people have been trying to get up in Australia and in the UK and elsewhere. And that's been around for quite a considerable period of time. What have been the tangible results of that, of having New Zealand First in coalition with, at one time, I think, the Labour Party, and then now currently with the Nationals, the centre-right party?
Yeah, so the party goes back to before the recent coalitions as well. It was essentially formed by defections from the National Party by Winston Peters. His vehicle as well. Something to keep in mind. For many years, it has been the party of Winston Peters, and it's been perceived as the party of Winston Peters. And so he has got a number of wins for, say, himself or his direct backers, and not necessarily benefited nationalists in New Zealand all that time. There's a a good example, of course, in recent, you know, the last coalition with Jacinda Ardern. He was actually booted out of parliament by the voters after making that deal with Jacinda Ardern because he wasn't getting New Zealand First results. So It's been a bit of a mixed bag. But in this last election, especially, people seem to be very, very happy with Winston Peters, what he actually put into the coalition agreement, what he's actually delivering for people. So there is good progress there. The one issue that he's toned himself down on over the years, though, is immigration. So that was a big deal. Even, you know, one of the reasons why he went with Labour, we had the Labour Party opposed to immigration until very recently, even. But they've completely changed their tune on that as well. And it would be good to see some more from Winston Peters and from New Zealand First on the issue of immigration, mass migration into New Zealand. So that's probably the big issue we want them to deliver more on that they're not delivering on. When it comes to other issues, I would say they're doing a fairly good job pushing some socially conservative issues, pushing some issues that especially older generations, the boomers, kind of care about, they cater to. Looking after the boomers kind of is one of the features of New Zealand First, but that's really, you know, the more conservative boomers. So those have been the mainstays of the party.
Right. It's interesting. He emerged in New Zealand roughly at the same time that Pauline Hanson arrived in Australia as an elected lower house representative at the federal level. But she was always treated as, initially at least, and then I think continually, as an outcast and someone to be avoided. But Winston Peters doesn't, the impression I have at least, he's not portrayed in the same way in New Zealand, I guess because he's had to be relied on to form coalition government.
Yes, that's right. And his history goes back as well in New Zealand politics. He was sort of trained up. He's an older gentleman. He was trained up by the political elites of the time. He was friends with former prime ministers involved in their governments. So you could describe him as a statesman, an elder statesman, someone who has a lot of political experience. His forte is in foreign affairs at the moment. So he's been the Minister of Foreign Affairs a few times. He does a lot for New Zealand's image overseas. And that's another thing I would say that has held New Zealand First back a little bit as well. It's a double-edged sword to have your leader be outward focused as well, you know, dealing with international relations rather than dealing with domestic issues. But he has a deputy leader at the moment as well, who's very much focused on industry, primary industries, on mining, on oil exploration, gas, and building up economic nationalism. So the party is filling out its ranks a little bit more than it has in the past.
In previously, I know its election results have been mixed, but One Nation has traditionally been not very good at building out an organization and holding things together. Has New Zealand First been better at doing that? You know, forming a national organization, holding effective meetings, getting member involvement, building out the membership, all the things you need to do to run an effective political party, or is it still a one man type of operation?
So the interesting thing about New Zealand First that I didn't really realize until recently as well, and I didn't really take front and center stage until the last election, is that New Zealand First is actually the only party in New Zealand Parliament that allows remits from its members on the floor. So the entire party conference every single year is essentially the most democratic of any party, where there's various processes for members to actually put forward remits that get debated, discussed, voted on the floor, that then may make it into party policy. So there is a proper party hierarchy. There's a proper grassroots. There are people that are actually able to input from the low level of a party. You can actually input into what might make up the policy higher up. There is still a lot of control at the top of the party, of course, as there is in any party, and any successful party probably works that way. But that is a very important feature that I think has led to the party's growth in recent years, especially after COVID lockdowns and so on. You had the freedom movement and so on, people there looking for a home, looking for a party that would actually allow them to have democratic input. And there's a good example I can give you of, say, an inquiry into the COVID response that New Zealand had. The freedom movement people went into the New Zealand First Party. They debated this on the floor of the party. They passed a remit overwhelmingly, you know, with an overwhelming majority to do an inquiry into the a proper one into COVID. And that was actually picked up by the party, actually campaigned on, actually included in the coalition commitment, and has actually been delivered on as well. What the final results of the inquiry will be, we don't know yet, but it is a proper full-range inquiry into every possible facet of the COVID response. So there's an example of that kind of activism being possible and being carried out successfully within New Zealand First.
Interesting. I mean, I don't want to talk about COVID that much, although I'm very interested.
I'm just using it as a very recent example because
I thought the whole thing was crazy, but New Zealand gained international notoriety because of its COVID response, and I was always curious whether there would be a reckoning, a proper reckoning for that in due course. And do you think there is the prospect that Jacinda Ardern may not be Saint Jacinda anymore?
That is possible. It's on the table. I'm not a big believer in that happening. But I think the people who pushed for that to happen got as close as anyone could have gotten, you know, whatever we end up with at the end of the day. I think that was very successfully campaigned on to get a proper, at least as proper as a look into it as you could get in a Western democracy.
What has been the reaction in New Zealand to the Trump phenomenon? You know, Winston Peters and Pauline Hanson, to a certain extent, were a reaction against the liberalism of the 1980s and in the post-Cold War era. And now, many, many years later, it's America which is now reassessing all of its positions, essentially, on trade, immigration, and foreign policy that it kind of adopted during, well, certainly in the post-Cold War world. Has that prompted any similar reassessment in New Zealand amongst the major parties or amongst, I don't know, public intellectuals and the like?
And I wouldn't say so, in a large part because of Winston Peters being the foreign minister. He himself is more pro-Trump than anybody else in New Zealand. Not openly in a big way, but he would say positive things about Trump that would make that already makes you stand out, I think, in politics. He is on good terms with many of Trump's people. And America is our number two trading partner. So if China is our number one trading partner, America is our number two trading partner. And that puts us in a precarious position. And I would say that in general, New Zealanders believe that that's being navigated to an acceptable level. There's been no real drama. We don't really get that great of a deal from America to begin with. All the talk of free trade from America really is largely propaganda. I think if you look at the actual numbers, if you look at the actual tariffs that we face in New Zealand, it's already quite considerable. And we're hoping, at least I think, that the expectation is that somebody like Winston Peters, somebody like Christopher Luxon would properly negotiate with Trump and not try to throw the toys out of the cot and just handle that situation if and when it comes up. If you look at the polling that companies do here in terms of what Trump support looks like in New Zealand, it's something I've noted over the last 8 years, especially among young people. Trump support is increased and continues to increase, especially among older generations, very anti-Trump, people who are putting plugged into the TV, people who are watching the 6 o'clock news. Older generations tend to be very anti-Trump. Those who are on social media tend to be more pro-Trump. And it seems like looking at the demographic numbers, when you look at the under 40s, especially the under 25s, there's possibly even an outright majority of young men in New Zealand who actually view Trump in quite a favorable way.
It's true to say that New Zealand's exports to the United States are predominantly agricultural and dairy and other things, right? And the US is notoriously, have long been notoriously protectionist when it comes to those areas. So,
So for all of the propaganda that they give on free trade in America, for New Zealand, that's never been the deal. So even though they're our number two trading partner with China as our number one trading partner, the actual tariffs on us are already considerable. and they're not likely to change. I don't think people expect them to change because of the role that Winston Peters plays, the role that Christopher Luxon, who's the Prime Minister, plays. They're both very pro-business people, very much friendly with Trump. They're not out there to pick a fight. People expect them to simply behave in a professional way. And we even saw this recently with the High Commissioner to the United Kingdom, who was a Labour Party politician, Phil Goff. He'd been sent there as this kind of sending away of old politicians that we do in New Zealand. They get a fancy diplomatic post. He said something negative about Trump that leaked into the media, and he was actually instantly fired from his position as UK High Commissioner because he said something negative about Trump. So the New Zealand government is taking this very seriously, and we can expect that New Zealand won't get a bad deal, basically, or I should say a worse deal than we're already getting. So I don't see a big reassessment there in New Zealand. And if you look at the numbers of Trump support, people who support Trump in New Zealand, with the older generations who are plugged into the TV, it's very much negative. Sometimes Trump would have, say, a minus 60% approval rating with that demographic. But then if you look at young men under 40, you have a positive approval rating of Trump in New Zealand, especially if you get into the under 25s. I think for young men, you'd be looking almost at an outright majority of young men who are positive about Trump in New Zealand. So I think that our position there is not something that's going to be a big political one in the next few years.
No, I mean, it must be an asset, actually, to have someone who's had long-standing favorable things to say and has taken action against diplomats who have said silly things. We still have an ambassador to Washington, former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, who like so many people around the world, said, less than flattering things, and yet are still in their position. It would be hard to see how that makes sense, but it does continues. But what about the major parties? Have they because both of those, the two major parties prior to the 80s, would have had broad policies which wouldn't have been, at least on trade, wouldn't have been completely out of step with what is coming out of the US at the moment, right?
No. So New Zealand was a very protectionist country. In the 80s, the policy was called Fortress New Zealand. Mm. And Winston Peters is perhaps the last kind of legacy of proponent of Fortress New Zealand. Although in reality, New Zealand's tariffs have come down. There's no real campaign to put up tariffs and so on, in a large part because mostly it's agricultural exports that we do. Mm. And there isn't much other industry left in New Zealand to try and protect. But whether or not we make any moves to bring that up. For the most part, I would say across the board, Labour, National, even New Zealand First, generally speaking, in favour of free trade. And that's just largely because of New Zealand's exports.
Yeah. You are across the history of that in New Zealand, because just in my cursory reading of it, it was just very surprising to see, I think New Zealand's longest standing prime minister was very active at pushing back against the, 19th century British liberalism and sticking up for New Zealand and saying they're not going to be just a dumping ground for products from Britain. And that pushback against, 19th century liberalism, I always think has similarities to the situation we find ourselves in today, right?
Yes, it does seem like that's made a big comeback, and it's hard to see. It's hard to know for sure how Robert Muldoon's legacy is alive in New Zealand. He was of course a National Party Prime Minister. He was a friend of Winston Peters, he's viewed very negatively by the ACT Party, the modern day National Party as well, would generally view him quite negatively. But I don't see a big return. I don't see it's feasible to have a big return to that at the moment, in a large part because New Zealand was betrayed by the United Kingdom. Like, again, most of our exports at the time were to the United Kingdom. They joined the common market. There was a big realignment of New Zealand's economy that took place as a result of that. And that's sort of the New Zealand that we live in today. That's very much focused on exports to China, and the United States, very much focused on, you know, basically mass migration began as part of a realignment there, unfortunately. So, I can't say that the current political situation really is backwards looking in that sense.
What about immigration then? Because that's the thing that has, I think it's become much more of a mainstream issue than it once was across the Anglosphere. It's a lot more permissible to talk about it. If I understand correctly, the numbers actually have come down a little bit in New Zealand in recent times, right? They were quite high, but they have both. Is it the Labour Party that was initially started the reduction and that's been continued, or
so the Labour Party escalated the numbers in the last few years. In the last 5 years, especially, Jacinda Ardern brought in record numbers. For years, the numbers didn't really come down. It just looked like they were coming down because New Zealanders were leaving the country. So a lot of the reduction in New Zealand's net immigration numbers have just been because it's New Zealanders have been fleeing the country. But the numbers have actually come down quite a bit. They're now back to the level that was considered normal in, say, the 2010s. So for the last 25 years, for the 21st century, we're sort of at the normal. But that, I would say, that normal is the mass migration. What we had for several years under Jacinda Ardern was insane numbers of people coming into the country, and that was in 2023 was 5% of the population arrived in just a single year. So those kinds of numbers that we had, 5%.
So that's net overseas migration, or equivalent of 5% of the population, or people returning. Is that for people returning? Were they all citizens?
So that's not in this case, I'm not factoring in people who were returning as well. This is purely saying that 5% of the population in the country right now arrived in the last, arrived in the last 12 months of 2023. It's changed now. It's down to, you know, the regular sort of 2% that most Western countries have, 2-3%. But those were the numbers that we were looking at.
And what have the consequences been in New Zealand? And what is the makeup of that immigration program? Is it, I suspect, predominantly from China, or a bit more from India in recent times?
So during that time, India overtook China as sort of the predominant country, you know, that we were getting migrants from. And it has resulted in massive changes in just my neighborhoods. I would say we have neighborhoods that are majority Indian now. And in a large number of suburbs in Auckland, you can see schools where things have changed a dramatic change from what used to be would have been majority European areas to majority Indian areas in the space of just, say, 5 to 10 years. The actual political ramifications have not fully been felt yet. There has been an increase, and so a lot of the immigration opposition in New Zealand actually comes from the Maori. So the young Maori in particular are very anti-mass migration, although politically they're not allowed to express it because they're on the left wing. But on the ground, there's actually increasing violence against Chinese and Indian migrants in Auckland from Maori in particular when it comes to public transport and so on. So you do see those issues becoming far more serious. But for the most part, because we're getting economic migrants, these are people who are here to work and to make money. Most of the consequences are economic, and so suppression of wages and so on would be a really big deal in New Zealand, and a dramatic escalation of housing costs as well. So the house prices have seen insane increases just purely due to mass migration.
And that would be concentrated in Auckland, right?
It is concentrated in Auckland, but it flows down to the entire country because the Aucklanders will then flee the country. They cash out and move away, especially older generations or people who want to start a family and they can't afford to live in Auckland, then they move away. So the house prices across the entire country are completely out of control. They've come down a little bit now, but not to the point where anybody could say that housing is affordable. I know you have the exact same problem in Australia.
It's a familiar tale across the Western world. So you have a centre-right government. I think at one stage I was looking at it because Queensland, where I'm based, is actually larger than New Zealand, and so we can lay claim to being the largest centre-right government in the Anglo Commonwealth. but you guys are, I think, number two. And obviously the only sovereign independent state with a centre-right government. And he's better than the alternative, I no doubt. But what are your main complaints with the current National Party? What don't they get, and where should they be heading that they're not heading?
The big issues that they're being attacked on by their coalition partners, probably I would say that's the way that they should be heading. But you have, especially on what broadly is called wokeness by its opponents. But if I drill down into it, you have the libertarians on one side pushing back very strongly against racial hierarchy in New Zealand, where we have an increasing number of laws around, say, favoring Maori or giving favorable deal to Maori or favorable mm-hmm. treatment to Maori, largely over historical grievances. The ACT Party is pushing back against that in terms of saying, you know, one law for all, equal treatment for everybody. And interestingly enough, immigration plays into this quite a lot as well, because obviously the big waves of recent immigrants, they don't want to be treated less than anybody else in the country. Mm-hmm. So this is why immigration is a difficult issue to deal with the ACT Party, because they push hard on that. New Zealand First is similarly focused on that particular issue as well. What you could broadly say is that sort of the racial element of wokeness, and looking at different laws for different ethnic groups. And the National Party is very, very weak on that, and they refuse to actually address the issue. So that's something that the National Party is effectively committed to, as sort of a strange racial hierarchy within New Zealand that they see as sort of redressing past racial grievances. So affirmative action programs and so on, that they are massively in favor of those.
Yeah, I mean, so just to be clear, the ACT, which is the more libertarianish party, are they critical of mass migration, or
so? They're not critical of mass migration because they see it as an economic opportunity,
right? But they are against the racial preferencing affirmative.
They're
action.
Against race, exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, but of course, that leads into the issue of like, well, what about New Zealanders? So this is the opportunity for people to step in and say, what about the ethnic group of New Zealanders, right? The Anglo-Celtic people, the settlers, the people who built this country, what about their place in New Zealand? And so you don't have anyone actively pushing back against them from that angle. It's purely everybody in the world should be treated the same if they step foot in New Zealand. That's the sort of approach that that goes on from the more, from the libertarians. And then the other part of the centre-right government, the liberal part, is in favour of affirmative action, basically, is what they call it in America. We don't call it that here, but I think the listeners would understand the context of affirmative action. And you have this obviously with the Aboriginals in a different form in Australia. So that's a big problem that's causing him a lot of headaches, and that I think he could make some big improvements on. The other one is the issue of all of the trans stuff, the LGBT issues. Again, his government is very much in favor of the trans agenda, effectively, and getting rid of sexuality education in schools is something that New Zealand First, for instance, is pushing on very strongly, trying to ban hormones and sexual mutilation of children. Again, very difficult, basically impossible to get that passed to the National Party, impossible to get that passed Christopher Luxon. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because I suspect that it's probably similar to Australia, where the rank and file of the National Party probably hate that stuff.
Yes.
But at the political level, they're being told that they don't want to engage in a culture war or this, that, and the other. And so as a result, saying, sticking up for biological reality is some sort of revolutionary statement, where it should really just be the absolute base level evidence of sanity.
You think you have a centre-right government, you can do this. No, you can't, right? So that's our big problem in New Zealand at the moment. You think, cool, we have a centre-right government, we can fix this stuff. And it's almost impossible to fix it. There is a big political scandal that's brewing in New Zealand at the moment. It's an active issue, which is from a Green Party MP who had a social media account where he was posting essentially terminology and symbolism and photos to do with pedophilia and exploitation of children and so on, claiming that this is part of the the rainbow community and this is the queer culture and they're just playing around and he was, you know, it's not serious. And the Green Party's actually come out and defended him instead of just kicking him out, saying, oh, wow, we've got this guy who looks like a pervert, you know, who looks like he might be, maybe he's not engaging in criminal activity, but he's making light or promoting things that are actually illegal and completely disgusting and immoral. Winston Peters has jumped on that and is very actively pushing back against the Green Party on this. And you can see in the broader culture that this sort of shifts people against that whole agenda because they see, like, hang on a minute, those people who are talking about the trans kids, they're also protecting this guy who's posting terminology and symbolism to do with pedophilia. So this is a live issue in New Zealand at the moment. So it's I can't give you too many details as it's unfolding. But
sure.
It's a very, very big deal.
Why do you think the center-right party can't act on some of what I think are the more easy social issues like the biological reality issue? You know, Trump comes out and has a big, great statement with incredible optics with all these young girls going, hooray, you've got rid of, you know, men and women's sport. Happily says, you know, men can't be women and vice versa. And in Australia, we have a Senate, which is always difficult to get stuff through. And that's always the excuse which is given amongst many for why some of these things can't be tackled. But in New Zealand, you don't have that. So we look across envious of you guys and think, well, you can just pass stuff through if Team Right gets in charge. But what excuses are used? Why does it not?
So even things like equality in sports, say no men competing in women's sports, was part of the coalition agreement, something that New Zealand First campaigned on, something they got a deal on. But then you have the National Party minister responsible for sporting. He's a liberal. He's like a pro-trans guy. And so he's dragging his feet on on implementing that. So actually getting that across the line suddenly turns into something that's very, very difficult. Yeah, why does it have to be like that? Is a question, unfortunately, that I can't answer, other than the fact that, you know, when we talk about a center-right government, you're including a lot of people who are extremely liberal in that. And so it's not actually, there is actually no political majority against this in Parliament, even though the majority of the voters who put them there are against it.
Yeah. Well, when you look around the Anglosphere from your perch there in New Zealand, are there areas where you think from a conservative perspective you're behind and areas where you think, oh, God, at least we're not as bad as the Canadians or not as bad as the Brits,
or
the Australians, God forbid, yeah.
Yes. So the especially the Canadians and the Brits, I would see that we're in a much better position than them. If we had had another 3 years of the Labour Party, we would probably be in a really bad position, as they are. A big part of the campaign here that has been followed through on is basically free speech issues, okay, killing off any kind of hate speech legislation, making sure that we don't get more internet crimes where people get arrested for memes. But in that being said, I know people personally who still get recently have gotten visits for things that they've posted online and been investigated by the police, but this is usually in quite a limited context in New Zealand to do with, say, things like firearms licensing, where there is actually hate, there's sort of like hate crime legislation buried in there. And so particular segments of the population, if you're in a particular you're after something specific like firearms licensing, then you run afoul of these. The ACT Party, again, is actually rewriting that legislation, is going to get rid of that. So hopefully we actually get more positive steps in terms of freedom of speech and freedom of expression in New Zealand. That's probably the biggest one where we can say, oh, yeah, things feel like we're in quite a good space compared to even Australia and especially Britain and also Canada.
Yeah, right. And what about at the universities? Are there any... is it possible these days to be a professor who expresses conservative views, or have they just been completely expropriated from
that? Yeah, I'm not sure we have very many of those left. But you could be, especially in the current in political environment. And there's a lot of pressure being put on universities to protect freedom of speech, to allow freedom of expression. Our Free Speech Union is very, very active as well as a lobby group.
Okay, yeah.
And wields considerable political power to the point where if you look at what leftists, if you look at the leftists arguing who they see as their main threat, it seems to me like most leftists in New Zealand see the Free Speech Union as one of their biggest threats. So whenever they're complaining about fascism in New Zealand, it's about the Free Speech Union. So that's a good, I can put in a good word for them, even though I have some disagreements because, again, Free Speech Union is pro a lot of this trans stuff as well. But when it comes to universities, they've been doing a really good job. And the leftists in the universities really do feel like they're under assault. And they should feel like that, of course.
It sounds like it is possible to collaborate with elements of the libertarian wing and I guess the traditional centre-right party to achieve some positive results in New Zealand. And this phenomenon also exists across the Western world where you get a whole stack of micro right parties. We have a whole stack of them at the upcoming Australian federal election. Do you think there's ever a way that we might return to a more traditional two-party system where those parties are incorporated into a more traditional system and their views are expressed or allowed to be debated within the more traditional parties?
Depending on your political system, that might be possible. I think that with New Zealand's MMP, mixed member proportional system, that could never really happen because it's designed to sort of fragment, right? So if you have a block that represents, say, half the population, it's quite likely to break up into two blocks that are 25% and 25% and so on. So I think for us, I just don't see that on the cards. We do, however, get lots of micro parties. I've been involved with one now for the last two election cycles, the New Conservatives, who are primarily a socially conservative party, pushing for socially conservative policies. But what happens in election times is that the voters look at the 5% threshold and they just go for the best thing they think will get across the line. So voters like to vote for winners. And if you don't look like a winner, well, then they pivot to the winner. Or if they're unhappy with, if there's a particular election where voters are really unhappy with, say, Winston Peters, or they're really unhappy with the National Party, then you might get more votes. And then in the next election, all your voters disappear again. So that's sort of the dynamic we have here in New Zealand. And the percentage of micro parties that get the votes, they tend to add up to about 3%. So there's about a 3% wastage that could be incorporated into something like New Zealand First. If they were willing to accommodate all of that and people were willing to work together. But at the same time, it seems like there's always going to be a fringe and people spend a little bit too much time wondering, how do we get rid of the fringe? How do we get rid of the crazy? Like, how do we get rid of the egos? And I think maybe you just have to accept that those will always exist. And it seems like, people will naturally try and gravitate towards something that works. And like I said, people want to be winners. So something for you Australians to figure out if you can get to that point where, and I can't solve that for you. And of course, it's difficult with a first past the post election.
Well, we have a preferential at the federal level, but it has been done before. I mean, back in Menzies, our longest serving prime minister famously was able to bring a whole lot of fractious centre-right organisations and parties together during the Second World War, actually, and pull together to make a very successful party. So who knows? I won't keep you too much longer, but have you given any thought to what Australia and New Zealand should do in this brave new world? I mean, things are changing dramatically, and it doesn't seem possible to go back to rely on, in the way we did, the United Kingdom and some of the more traditional allies. How do you think we should play this new great game?
Like I said right at the beginning of this interview, the struggle that we have with Australia is that Australia almost feels like Australia is a parasite that's sucking things away from New Zealand. But you know, historically, of course, like, we have great relations with our countries, and we basically have free movement, you know, between New Zealand and Australia. Unfortunately, it does seem to benefit you guys a lot more. And even though there are some people who think that we should be more independent, I definitely know some people on the right wing who think, you know, we need to be more independent from Australia. We need to be charting our own way, and Australia is holding us back. What I think is actually going to happen is the countries are going to come closer together, and New Zealand and Australia will continue to build the friendship, the relationship that we have. You will continually see people moving backwards and forwards between Australia and New Zealand. You know, Australia will have a very large percentage of New Zealanders who live there and work there. Whether we'll actually see any kind of political alignment between Australia and New Zealand, I'm not sure. I think in terms of the major parties, we sort of do have that. I think if you look at our Labour Party and your Labour Party, you look at our National Party, your Liberals and your Nationals together, you see very similar political developments. So you sometimes see campaign ideas that are just outright stolen from New Zealand in your elections.
The Liberal Party slogan at this federal election, I think we've taken it directly from you guys, back on track, right?
So that's exactly the example, yes.
Cool, man. And so generally, an optimistic take going forward, how do you see things playing out in New Zealand over the next 10 years?
Anything can happen. It's very hard to make predictions about the future. If we were looking at the polling recently, the government was actually down quite a bit in the polls, largely simply due to the economic situation continuing to deteriorate, which, in my opinion, they should have just fixed quicker. They should have just gone and taken more radical measures. But again, the National Party dragged its feet and took quite a long time to fix things up. But it looks like the economic situation in New Zealand will begin an upward trend. And if that upward trend continues, then the government should be reelected. That seems to be a natural progression. It also means you're going to see ACT and New Zealand First double down on the issues that they campaigned on, the issues that they tried to get the National Party to give them concessions on, more right-wing issues that we've been discussing. So that's my positive vision for New Zealand, is that both our Libertarian and our Nationalist Party will continue to double down on things that are actually good for New Zealand. Hopefully, New Zealand First will really embrace a more anti-immigration position. I think if we look at the polling numbers, if they want to bring in youth votes, because their demographic skews older, and going anti-woke works well with the older folks, if they really want to bring in younger folks for New Zealand, they need to, you know, into New Zealand First, they need to be dealing with the issue of immigration and all of the problems it causes around depressing wages, increasing house prices, shredding social cohesion, you know, destroying the future of you know, the ethnic New Zealanders, the settler, the founding stock. So that is a really good opportunity for them. And I see things can get better in the next 10 years if we can fix those fundamental problems. There is that possibility to properly defeat the left for a long, long time. And if you do look at New Zealand's governance over the last 100 years, there have been stretches where the Labour Party has been kept out of power for you know, very, very long time, you know, sometimes four or five terms even, you know, talking it's not too difficult to keep them out of power for 10 years or 15 years even.
Well, look, I've really appreciated having a chat, and I just do think it's useful to get different perspectives from across the Anglosphere, because everyone is trying to wrestle with these the new environment in their own way. But there are definitely common themes, and particularly between Australia and New Zealand, because we understand each other best, and have, you know, obviously lots of stuff in common. So I've enjoyed chatting and look forward to catching up further in future.
Well, thank you for your time. And I'll just let people know if they want to follow my work as well and you know, find out more about New Zealand's political situation. I have run a website, rightminds.nz. I write columns for a sort of right-wing media site for New Zealand called goodoil.nz, goodoil.news. And you can find my work there or on rightminds.nz. And I also have a regular show that I do for Reality Check Radio, RCR. You can go to rcr.media. And every week I'll do a weekly political show on the political situation in New Zealand. And I'll also do regular interviews with usually with nationalists from around the world, but also with other people on other topics. Sometimes I cover religious topics or historical topics and so on. Those all tickle my fancy.
Yeah, the history I find particularly interesting too. I'll drop all that information in the show notes so people can check it out and follow your work. Appreciate it once again, Dewey. Take it easy, man.
Well, thank you very much.